An interview with Gareth Evans at Yale University on December 10th, 1997, and we will be discussing Australia's role in Cambodia. Okay, so to start out with Mr. Evans, would you just, for the record, give some background on your political career for the reader?
I became Australia's foreign minister in September 1988. Before that, I had been a minister in three other portfolios from 1983 and in politics since 1978 as a senator. Subsequently, I stayed foreign minister until 1996 when we lost the election. I'm now deputy leader of the opposition. But my background in relation to the Cambodian issue also goes right back personally to a visit I'd made to the country as a student in 68. So I had a sort of fairly intense interest in the situation there, and when the opportunity came for me as foreign minister to try and do something to kickstart the peace process, it was something that had some attractions, not only from a professional diplomatic point of view, from Australian national interest point of view, but also from a personal point of view.
Okay, good. Then I think we'll start the questions on Cambodia. And you had brought along with you a book by Ken Berry on Cambodia from the Australian point of view. And
yes, just go on.
Well, he said that a book has to start somewhere, and the interview has to start somewhere, and it turns out that we chose both the same place to start, which was the first Paris Peace Conference in the summer of 1989. So I thought I'd start there.
Yeah, this was the big attempt by the French to bring things to fruition around the theory of a quadripartite transitional government, which I think had been most people's concept of until then as to how the situation might ultimately be resolved. There were mixed views about whether a political settlement could or should precede a military settlement, but they're all variations on the theme of some kind of power-sharing arrangement which would recognise the reality of the fairly intimate relationship between the three non-SOC parties, namely the Khmer Rouge and Hun Sen Phuc and the and Son Sann's party. Mm-hmm. Notwithstanding all the previous horror of the genocide, the Vietnamese invasion had brought them together, and they were operating as a coalition. But there needed to be a solution which reflected the reality of that working cooperation,
mm-hmm, right,
and also the reality of Hun Sen's SOC government on the ground. And it was thought by everyone, me included, that quadripartite solution was the only way forward, even though it was not uncontroversial in terms of our various domestic constituencies, all of whom had the horrors at the prospect of any continuing cooperation with the Khmer Rouge. But notwithstanding that approach, the Paris Conference did fail, and it failed essentially, when you boil it all down, on the demand of the CGDK, the Tripartite Coalition, and the various international backers of that coalition for an equal share of power for each of the four factions, including the Khmer Rouge, in any transitional administration. And on the other hand, the absolute unwillingness of Hun Sen and its international backers, and in particular, of course, Vietnam and the Soviet Union, mm-hmm, to be willing to concede that. And for all the manoeuvrings and all the detail, essentially that was the dynamic at work there, and that's what brought the conference to its knees, and that's why it became necessary to think of another way through the impasse in the aftermath of that failure.
Now, were you at the Paris conference that summer of 89, or was Australia represented there?
Oh, yes, we were there.
Okay.
And, I was one of those who was very disappointed by the outcome of it. I can't pretend that I was a major player at that stage, but nonetheless, we were participants in the process, and it was a very disappointing one. I had in fact made some suggestions which are documented in the very book, which by the way is an excellent detailed chronology and analysis of the Australian involvement, which I've just been refreshing my memory on, but not sufficiently, I think, for the purpose of this interview. When in doubt on any matter of detail, scholars can feel free to rely on the Berry book as an absolutely meticulously accurate and detailed account of the Australian and my own involvement. So anything I say will really be simply supplementary impressions to the basic stuff that's in this book.
Okay. After the failure of that first conference, as I understand it, Australia, Indonesia, France, and others made an intensive effort to restart the talks. So how was Australia involved in that, and what happened?
Well, this was the period of the most intense and most significant involvement of Australia, the period after the Paris conference. And I think it all really began with the conversation that I had with Stephen Solars at the time of the General Assembly session early in October 1989. Mm-hmm. I had a discussion with him. We're old friends in the Australian Ambassador's residence in Beekman Place, with just myself, Solars, and in fact another Australian diplomat, three of us talking through this. And this was the occasion when Stephen raised with me an idea that had been knocking around in his mind for some months, in which he canvassed with various people in the US administration, not with any reaction of any positive or useful kind. And that was for essentially a UN role as the circuit breaker in the Cambodian peace process, the idea being that something could be done on the basis of the Namibian example, but on a rather more extended scale, with the UN actually playing the role of an interim government in which they wouldn't merely supervise or monitor an election process, but would actually organize that election process and have a critical role in the administration of the country during the period leading up to the election, a much more hands-on role than had previously been contemplated. This was an idea which I thought immediately had some attractions, in that it was a completely different idea to variations on the quadripartite theme, which had been around for a long time, which seemed to be going nowhere, and one that had the potential, if it could only attract the support of Vietnam and SOC in the first instance, who obviously stood to lose from anything which pushed them out of a central governing role during the transitional period, and if it could also win the support of China, because of course anything involving a major role for the UN had to contend immediately with China's role as a member of the Permanent Five, and its patronage of the Khmer Rouge, and its unwillingness hitherto to do anything which would put the Khmer Rouge's status at risk. And it seemed to me that there was, however, potentially something in it for everyone, in terms of being a face-saving context in which the Chinese could withdraw away of the SOC and the Vietnamese, giving up governing authority without conceding it directly to the Khmer Rouge in whole or part. And equally, having attractions for the ASEANs and the other Cambodian factions as a way simply of moving the whole game forward, not necessarily on quite as favourable terms as might have been involved in the quadripartite model, but nonetheless not going backwards.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea immediately, to me, had some had quite a lot of resonance, and I expressed a great deal of interest to Solars in it. It was extremely undeveloped. It was simply an idea, and it bore some resemblance to an idea that Sihanouk had himself floated a couple of years earlier for a UN trusteeship role, but again, which had never been fleshed out or developed, but it certainly had some resonance to that.
Okay.
And I, in fact, said, walking away to the Australian diplomat, who should remain unnamed, gee, that was interesting. I think we might have the bones of something that could actually work here. And the diplomat in question said, Harumph, do you really think so? I mean, it sounded like a heap of nonsense to me and just a great waste of everyone's time. I said, well, on the contrary, and I think we ought to do some hard work following that up. We did just that. I spent some time talking it through with senior officials when I got back to Australia and just developing the concept a little more, and made then a public announcement of it in the Australian Parliament on the 24th of November 89, just outlining what seemed to me a way of breaking through the impasse, just laying out the concept of it, not in much detail.
Okay.
But we, that got quite a degree of publicity, and we also spread it widely around all the other Paris conference players. And the initial reactions from all of them were interested enough to make me make the judgment that it really did justify a fairly substantial diplomatic effort on our part to test and refine the idea further, which we then did with a very detailed exercise in shuttle diplomacy led by senior Australian official Michael Costello, then the deputy head of my department, subsequently the secretary of it.
Mm-hmm.
And he went to some 30 major meetings with key players in 13 different countries over a 21-day period from the 12th of December 89 through the 19th of January 1990. This is all documented in the Berry book. But this, I think, was the crucial breakthrough in the sense of picking up an idea and then really getting out and testing it and refining it. He and I spoke constantly over the telephone and exchanges of cables, and the idea got more and more refined as the Odyssey proceeded.
Okay. I wanted to ask you something about that, because that kind of diplomacy is, key in developing these kinds of issues of, building support. Was there initially a resistance to the idea of the UN taking such a major role, and then how did you overcome that if you did meet with resistance?
Well, it was thought intriguing, the notion that the UN might be the vehicle for breaking the impasse. Remember, this is the end of 89. It's tumultuous year with the end of the Cold War. It's at a period when there's just a recognition that the ice floes were breaking up all over the place, that it was possible to think in a new and creative way about all sorts of things happening internationally, and in particular about a role for the UN. We weren't quite at this stage at the height of the passion which existed for an all too short period for the UN to get involved in just about everything under the sun.
That's right.
Which culminating in the Chapter 7 operation, the Gulf War, and a lot of other things happening. But it was coming off the back of what had been a successful operation in Namibia.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the example, I think, most present to people's mind,
that
how that example might be picked up and played with.
Okay.
But as always with this kind of diplomacy, what it's all about is finding formulae which meet people's perceived national interests and provide the face savers, where retreats are necessary, and give the necessary degree of cover if people are not getting optimal outcomes, at least a decently suboptimal one. And the whole point about this was that I saw almost immediately that this had the potential, when you looked at it from every single perspective, of meeting those criteria. Remember that this is probably the most complex single, not the biggest international problem it was, but certainly one of the most complex, because you had three layers of players. You had the factions. Mm-hmm. It was a long and bloody internecine history within the country itself. You had their immediate regional patrons, Vietnam in the case of Sok, and the other ASEANs in the case of the CGDK. You had then the superpower patrons standing behind them, China in the case of the Khmer Rouge, Russia in the case of Sok, and the United States and France in the case of Sihanouk and the non-communist members of the CGDK coalition.
Mm-hmm.
You really did have an extraordinary number of players with different interests, all of whom had to be satisfied. So the search was on, and that's what all this diplomacy was about, to test the reaction of every single one of them, beginning with the Vietnamese and the Chinese and Hun Sen himself. And that's the first three calls that Costello made, because unless they were potentially interested, as on the face of having the most to lose, this wasn't going anywhere. I mean, the Khmer Rouge always had the most to lose of all, but the judgment was made very early on that the Khmer Rouge, without the support of the Chinese, would not be able to be a decisive player, and thus it proved to be in the event. And so it was a matter of really positioning all the other players to see what the art of the possible was. Anyway, the short point is that by the end of that dialogue process, I had a sufficiently clear story to tell to Ali Alatas, who was a good friend and colleague of mine. We'd become foreign ministers of Wallace at the same time in September 88. We'd been through the trauma of the Paris Peace Conference together. We'd been through the trauma of patching up Australia-Indonesia bilateral relations, which is a long saga to tell you about on another occasion. We had the ordeal of fire of dealing with the East Timor problem, which is a constant recurring theme in Australia-Indonesia relations. And we had a very, very good, close, professional working relationship. And he, as co-chairman of the Paris Conference process, I saw as being an absolutely critical player in all of this. And all my efforts were devoted towards getting some ideas together, which I saw him as being the key player in advancing.
So
in that context, we spent a lot of time keeping Indonesia up to speed with what we were up to, and in particular encouraging the Indonesians to have a meeting sooner rather than later in Jakarta to explore this idea. Alatas agreed with that, and in February 1990, what I think was probably the critical meeting in terms of what subsequently followed, was in fact held in Jakarta. And Indonesia asked Australia to work behind the scenes as a resource delegation for that meeting. And in that context, we put a huge effort into preparing the famous Red Book, which was a set of six working papers, which were a refinement and a development over 160 odd pages of the ideas that had first emerged and were refined in the shuttle diplomacy process. But then we made a major effort to turn that into a working bones of an operational plan covering all the different dimensions: civil administration, election organization, military, security, plus the conceptual issues involved in terms of sovereignty, structure of government, and options and possibilities. We even went so far as to cost what the UN operation might look like, and it's quite remarkable that the figure we came up with of $1.3 billion US for what we conceptualised as an 18-month operation, in fact, was as close as it was to the final actual cost of the UN operation, which was $1.7 billion for a two-year operation.
That's remarkable.
There were a number of differences in the way in which the missions turned out to be finally structured. But I think if you trace the whole course of what happened, there's an enormous amount comes right back to the Australian proposal as it was refined and developed in this very short period. and as it was conceptualised and given operational outline and even budgetary outline in those working papers for the February 1990 meeting.
No, just on the Red Book, the working papers, were they developed as a part of the meeting in Jakarta or immediately following that?
No, they were developed very deliberately as a resource document for the meeting in Jakarta.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And they were the documents, in fact, much to the chagrin of the French, who throughout were very cautious about the Australian role, if I can put it gently. They were, you know, the document that that actually mattered. We made it clear that, and Alitas made it clear that they were there as a resource document to be taken or left as the mood of the joint Jakarta informal meeting had it. But in fact, it was the document around which everything resolved. We went to the trouble of actually translating key chunks of it into Khmer, which made a huge impact on all the Cambodian players. Nobody had ever done them the courtesy or taken the time or trouble to do that. But we didn't try and do it for every last page of the thing, but key concepts which were absolutely critical to convey and the key balances that we were trying to strike. And we thought it was absolutely critical that they be communicated in a language with which all the players were absolutely familiar rather than having to work in English or French. And
you had parties there. You had the four parties as well as international players there.
Yeah, not all. It wasn't all the Paris cast. It was essentially a regional meeting that the Indonesians had convened. And it was, for that reason, a meeting that could not have been decisive in moving things forward, because you would have had to put the proceeds of it back into a Paris conference format, and that's, of course, eventually what happened. But it certainly had the key players there, and including the French as joint chairman. But it was a deliberate exercise in convening, as I recall, the regional. It was a deliberate attempt to just have a regional input rather than to try and develop momentum from that.
Yeah.
In the event, of course, the Jakarta meeting did fail. The sticking points were pretty much the same as those which caused the Paris conference to fail. The power sharing issue, which just couldn't be finally resolved. The device we had, of course, just interpolated in brackets here, which subsequently became the SNC, or the Supreme National Council, was the concept we developed was a formal organisation embodying the sovereignty of the country in which the four factions would be represented. The difference from the earlier quadripartite power-sharing model, however, being that particular body would not be exercising formal executive authority as the government, quote-unquote, of the country. It was there as the sort of repository of sovereignty. It was there as the potential holder of the UN seat. But the difference was it wouldn't be of the government. Nonetheless, from the party's point of view, a lot of the same issues arose about what the balance between the different factions on this supreme body would be, whether it would be an equal sharing arrangement or some weighted formula, and who would be chairman of it and so on.
Yeah.
And so there's a lot of pushing and shoving and manoeuvring on that. But the other issue which came into play, as it had in Paris, but even more starkly in Jakarta, was whether or not there'd be a reference to genocide in the relevant documents, with the Khmer Rouge, of course, resisting that, and the SOC insisting upon it. Nonetheless, even though the conference failed, I think the significance of it was that the idea of the UN role was absolutely alive and well, and a huge number of issues had in fact been agreed upon. There's a summarised in the very book, and I won't track over that now, but I mean, some of the Paris principles have been adopted and reapplied. The principle of occupying the Cambodian seat at the UN with the so-called Supreme National Council. The need for a whole series of arrangements about return of refugees and treatment of prisoners and reconstruction issues were all endorsed. And the general principle of the UN role in the civil administration of the country and in the organisation of elections, the critical elements of the Australian peace plan, were basically endorsed. So, everyone came away feeling sort of exhausted and frustrated that so near and yet so far. But, I mean, looking back, that was the pivotal meeting.
That was bringing all the threads together. Yeah, okay.
And really, when you look at the next 2 years, this endlessly protracted process before it all came finally together again with the Paris Peace Conference at the end of 91. Really, everything that's in that final settlement can be traced back to material that was on the table, issues that were on the table, concepts that were on the table, in the Jakarta meeting, and which just simply took a long time to untangle and finally resolve.
Okay.
But really, it was all there.
Well, by September of 1990, the Security Council had adopted the framework that had evolved out of the Jakarta meeting. What were there refinements that were made in between those two dates, when the Jakarta meeting ended and the Security Council then adopted the framework?
The P5 did take it upon itself to pick up the pieces after the Jakarta meeting, and really that's where you talk about the Security Council, but really it was the P5 that were running this and had an endless series of meetings. Quite a lot of which Australia played a major role, although not very much acknowledged in the sort of official documentation, as well behind the scenes. But for example, at one stage we developed a single negotiating text, the famous SNT, as another way of moving the whole thing forward, as it was getting stymied in various directions, and as a way of bringing together in a single document in which all the competing things were traded off against each other. I mean, that was an Australian contribution. The concept of, I've forgotten when, you can find it again by the very book, but I remember another critical way of moving the game forward was another Australian suggestion that we deal with the genocide issue by looking forward rather than backwards, by talking about putting in place arrangements which would avoid the possibility of genocide ever occurring, rather, which got the G word in, but in a way which didn't directly attribute responsibility for the genocide of the past, and that became an important element. There was also another development was on the sort of the reconstruction side. There was a conference in Tokyo in which Australia again played a fairly major role in, which arose out of and was a further development of the one of the working committees in the original Paris Conference in 89, which further developed what was necessary to put together as part of the reconstruction package. So there was a whole series of strands that were sort of running, that were flowing around, a lot of in reinvention of the wheel, going back to basics and then laboriously reconstructing things which ended up being pretty much back where we started out in 1990. And really my memory is very hazy of who precisely did or said what to whom over that entire period between February 1990 and when it all finally came together in 91. It's as I said, meticulously documented in the Berry book. But I just remember it as a period of endless sort of circling and sniffing, like dogs are beside a lamppost. And the sort of breaking up and reforming of little groups and alliances and neuroses of one kind or another. And And it's very difficult to sort of identify the, you know, the really major peaks and valleys in that process. It was just laborious and difficult. A lot had to do with the personalities of the key players, and I think, you know, the key breakthrough eventually came when the Pattaya, the famous Pattaya meetings when in Thailand. P-A-T-T-A-Y-A.
Oh, okay, thank you.
when Sihanouk and Hun Sen basically agreed, as I record, on the, you know, the structure and shape of the Supreme National Council, and that was a pretty critical,
right,
you know, breakthrough,
yeah,
and then,
yeah,
resolving that part of it and helping to move the game forward. But throughout the process, I think you know, the Chinese played a pretty constructive role, and they were critical, obviously, to, always critical to the ultimate success of this. And
how did the Chinese change their position over that time period that began to facilitate the solution?
I think the Chinese were always, always helpful and cooperative players in this. I have no complaint personally about the role that the Chinese played. They wanted to get the best deal, in a sense, for their clients, the Khmer Rouge. But I think they realised that they were not exactly on a winner in terms of international public opinion,
mm-hmm,
in terms of that relationship, and that, you know, what they had wanted to do through their support of the Khmer Rouge, namely to deny Vietnam uncontested hegemony over the whole of Indochina, that aspiration had largely succeeded. They weren't going to get much more out of it in terms of regional realpolitik.
Mm-hmm.
The best thing they could get out of it was the effective neutralization of, you know, the other Indo-Chinese countries, and thus the significance of those formulae about neutral and sort of unaligned Cambodia, which was an important part of the whole Paris process, getting that concept established in the Chinese system. They did want to, they played fairly hard for all on the references to genocide and so on in terms of, you know, protecting the KR position. And generally made life reasonably miserable for the Vietnamese stroke SOC position.
Mm-hmm.
But I saw them throughout as a country which had basically made the decision that it wanted out of the whole imbroglio, and, you know, wanted out on terms that were face-saving for it, wanted out on terms that didn't leave Vietnam, obviously, in uncontested,
yeah,
control of Cambodia, either directly or through its proxy on the ground, wanted out in circumstances where a genuine balance was re-established and some kind of political process. But all the rest is detail. I mean, once they made their mind to do that, and they made up their mind very early on,
okay,
that the Australian UN proposal was the vehicle for achieving this.
Okay.
And really, I think what you saw from the Chinese over this period, along with what you saw from everyone else,
so when
was simply the manoeuvring,
okay,
that was involved in getting that outcome with the basic concept being clear in their mind.
Okay. So when Michael Costello went to meet with them before the Jakarta meeting and after the first Paris conference, his reaction from them was fairly positive to your proposal?
Yes, it was. I mean, well, certainly sufficiently encouraging to justify us continuing.
Okay, yeah.
I mean, that was the key at that,
okay,
stage. That was,
yeah,
the criteria we were applying. If there'd been a big, fat no,
mm-hmm,
big rock in the path, obviously it would not have been worth pursuing, because the UN concept could not have gone anywhere without that.
Okay.
And the first thing that was done was to test the water with the Vietnamese, and Hun Sen were absolutely critical. The second job was to go to Beijing. That's exactly what happened.
Okay.
In fact, the Russians got tucked in between, because Igor Rogachev, the Russian
Deputy Prime Minister happened to be in Tokyo, where Costello was transiting between Phnom Penh and Beijing, which was a very useful reinforcement of the, you know, the basic Vietnam-Soviet Union Hun Sen position.
Okay, cool.
Costello had all of that firmly in his mind when he went to talk to the Chinese.
Uh-huh.
And the Chinese were actually very interested in the whole thing, and they were absolutely critical.
And so his meeting with Hun Sen was also fairly positive?
Yeah, all those initial meetings were really more positive than I anticipated.
Yeah. Was the timing ripe? Is that why that was?
Yeah, I mean, exactly. I mean, you never get anywhere in these sorts of things unless, you know, the idea is ripe, or is right, and the time is ripe.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I think that's exactly the combination that we had. There was this enormous frustration with the failure of the Paris Conference. There was a recognition that the quadripartite model was just not going everywhere. Everyone was ducking too far. Moreover, publics were getting more restless in the Western democracies with the quadripartite. That was certainly true in my own country.
Yeah, okay.
The other elements, the mood was there. The mood was receptive for a new idea coming on the scene, which would actually show a way through the impasse. And I think the third critical element in the equation, I mean, it sounds like an awful bit of, you know, sort of drum beating for Australia, but the third critical element was the energy and the commitment with which this idea was pursued. If it had just been another idea, I mean, the idea was in a sense around. Solas had been talking to people about it. But he said, look, I can't get anyone, you know, really very interested. I said, oh yes, that might be a way through it. He said, what it needs is a government which is in, you know, good shape, good odour, if you like, around the place, and which will be listened to as a government. Not just an individual, but it needs a government to pick this up and run with it, to get it into, you know, the key sort of meetings and to really push it. And he said that he thought Australia was as well equipped as anyone to do this because, you know, we were in pretty good standing with all the key players.
Right.
And at the same time, this is the classic middle power diplomacy line. I mean, we weren't so big that we frightened the horses anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
We were big enough to be competent and efficient and well resourced, and, you know, to have a voice that would be listened to. But we weren't so big that we carried all the baggage that, you know, the major powers and obviously the superpowers did.
Yeah, so the United States could not have really launched that kind of initiative.
I frankly don't think they could have, and the US, Dick Solomon and so on, were very quick to recognise that and to be willing to put their weight and muscle, you know, essentially behind the Australian proposal.
Okay.
You see, there's a bit of background too that needs to be understood. The history of Australia's involvement in this does go back really quite a long way, but
okay.
In particular what I'm thinking of is an initiative that was taken by my predecessor, Bill Hayden, in 1984, which at the time really got right up the ASEAN noses, which it was a proposal basically to send Pol Pot off to an international war crimes tribunal, and to, if not actually recognise SOC, at least to, just trying to remember what exactly we were saying, but I'll stop the time, isn't it?
Oh.
What I'm thinking of was Australia, back in October 83, withdrew from co-sponsorship of the annual ASEAN resolution on Cambodia. We took the view that it was too one-sidedly critical of Vietnam, took insufficient account of Pol Pot's genocide,
okay,
and so on, which made ASEAN very displeased with us. Then in early 84, there was a sort of a peace proposal put forward by Australia. I've forgotten the detailed content of it. It was variations on a power-sharing model, but it also contained this element of sending Pol Pot off to a war crimes tribunal, which is not very practical then or now, but it was the sort of thing that was, again, calculated to get up ASEAN noses. Now, in the event, things were patched up with the ASEANs, but the point that needs to be borne in mind is that this little exercise stood us in terrifically good standing with the Vietnamese and the SOC, because we'd had this track record of showing, you know, under the new Labour government coming in to power, as we did in 83, after a long period of conservative rule, and the Conservatives, of course, had been the government which had taken us into the Vietnam conflict, and so on, as the Labour Party had been the government had taken us out of Vietnam and had been very critical of involvement. So you had all that sort of history, which was very, very useful set of cards to play when it came to 89 in terms of having a personal relationship with Minh Kat Thach, which Hayden, my predecessor, did in a major way, and I did in a lesser way. But it was there. And at the same time, I mean, our basic relationships with the ASEAN countries were very strong. And after that little frisson in 83, 84, they were patched up again. But it also served that little exercise of ours to distance ourselves from the United States position, on which was fiercely hostile to Vietnam or its works, you know, throughout. This MIAs, POWs, all that stuff, you know, you recall, was still alive and well during this period. So all of those things were pretty important in giving Australia the kind of credentials to do this. So you know, good idea, right time, country with the right credentials to pursue this kind of thing because of our access to and credibility with all the players at all the different levels we're talking about, except the Khmer Rouge, because we've had technical credentials with them. But the whole point of the exercise was to put the Khmer Rouge in a corner from which they couldn't come out. And finally pursuing it, you know, with the energy and the detail commitment that frankly startled all sorts of people. I mean, including the sort of hands-on involvement that I had. I mean, the preparation of the Red Book, I mean, Ken Berry reminds me in a footnote here in his book, it just takes my mind back to the extraordinary period we worked for. Days on end. It was an 8-day drafting session conducted basically in my ministerial office in Parliament House, which we worked with a team of officials for 18-hour days, drafting this 154-page series of working papers. We sent a mission up to military and other mission up to Cambodia to make a judgment about what was operationally necessary on the ground, and so we had to work it as well. It was a technical mission because Cambodia, Bangkok, and Sri Lanka, very quick now, page 58, visited the Thai Cambodia border area, Cambodia, Bangkok, to glean information about the administrative structure of the actual government on the ground, the departmental structure of it. So if we're talking about civil administration, we're working out a model for the UN, whether it was going to be a complete replacement model or a decapitation model where you just slice the top off and then reimpose officials, or whether it was to be a monitoring and supervision model. Somebody had to know what the hell was actually going on in terms of the structure of that government. So we did all that. And plus we made some judgments with a military team about what would be necessary to secure the joint and to run a cantonment exercise and demobilisation and disarmament of the armed forces. So we'd thought through all of that, plus we'd had another team working on costings and liaising with the UN and finding, getting some broad estimates of the order of magnitude involved, and having X number of personnel doing Y sort of tasks. And it was just a huge effort went into this, and I think anyone who looks back on the history of the period and goes back to these documents will in fact be quite startled by the scale and intensity. And the whole point of that, of course, it was to demonstrate that the thing could be done. If we had just left it at the level of high conceptual, sort of involvement and high conceptual framework stuff. I mean, an awful lot of people said, yes, that's very interesting, but, is it practical, is it workable, and, we've just gone off arguing endlessly about the structures of the power-sharing model, about whether or not genocide should be. Those arguments still took place. They were still showstoppers at the time, But the ground had shifted underneath.
Yeah, yeah.
And what had shifted was the perception that, hey, this is actually doable, this is affordable.
Yeah, and you demonstrated that, and you showed that.
And we demonstrated that, and yeah. I think that was absolutely our major contribution. I mean, again, everything that happened thereafter, we played an ongoing role, we nagged and stimulated and prodded, and we came up with single texts here and, you know, formally there, and reconstruction models here, yeah. And something else and something else, and we were pushing and poking.